You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda, your host as always, and I'm joined today by my colleague Prashant Parameswaran. How's it going today, Prashant?
Good, how are you?
Good. So sorry for last week's hiatus, but we're back with the podcast this week. And specifically, we're going to devote this episode to talking about a bilateral relationship that I don't think we've ever done on this podcast in the past 88 episodes or so. Specifically, last week, Singaporean Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong visited the United States for a state visit to commemorate 50 years of ties between the two countries. The two countries are close strategic partners, and Lee's visit to the United States comes just as the Obama administration enters its final 6 months in office. And, you know, this period raises some questions for U.S. partners and allies about the continuity of U.S. strategic and economic policy in the Asia-Pacific into the next administration during a particularly unusual, to say the least, election season here in the United States. So other important context, of course, includes the ongoing global fight against terror, where Singapore is also an active participant with the United States, ongoing difficulties in the aftermath of the South China Sea ruling a few weeks ago as well, which we've discussed extensively on this podcast. So Prashant, I understand that you've been tracking this visit very closely, so hopefully you can provide us with a broad rundown of what you see as the primary takeaways and the significance of Lee's visit to the United States. And particularly, you know, hopefully we can eke out some of the broader issues that come up for, you know, U.S. policy in the Asia-Pacific past the Obama administration, because, you know, I think some things came up during Lee's visit that make that discussion pertinent as well. So what were the main takeaways in your view?
Sure. I think White House officials were pegging the visit as an opportunity to accomplish two things. The first, as you said, is reaffirming the importance of the U.S.-Singapore strategic partnership. So this is the 50th anniversary of the U.S.-Singapore relationship, and it's an opportunity for both sides to talk not only about, you know, where the relationship is now, which is, you know, Singapore has been a vital economic and security partner for the United States for decades. It enjoys the mammoth share of U.S. foreign direct investment into Southeast Asia, and it still is and has been a crucial point for U.S. access. It serves as a home to the U.S. Navy Logistics Command Unit. So all these carrot exercises that we hear about that go on with a number of Southeast Asian and South Asian countries, those are housed out of Singapore. So it has a really crucial role to play, not just for the bilateral relationship, but also U.S. Regional influence and presence in Southeast Asia, including the U.S. rebalance. Singapore has also a particularly special role within the Obama administration. It was the Obama administration that formally upgraded the U.S.-Singapore relations to the level of a strategic partnership back in 2012. I think this visit was an opportunity for them to highlight not only what they've done before, but also look forward at how they're going to boost ties. I think two significant things came out of the U.S.-Singapore joint statement that struck me. A lot of them were things that already were rehashed, but these two things were important. The first one was Singapore's role in this new initiative called U.S.-ASEAN Connect, which Obama announced initially at the U.S.-ASEAN Sunnyland Summit in February. And what that is about is basically coordinating a lot of the things that the United States already does economically in Southeast Asia, and Singapore is one of the hubs for that. The second thing that struck me was additional opportunities for Singapore to train in Guam. The United States has been one of the key places which Singapore uses to train its armed forces personnel. And the Air Force is going to be getting opportunities to do that. I suspect we're going to hear a lot more about that in the coming months in terms of not only how important this is for bilateral relations, but what the U.S. and Singapore can do together regionally from Guam. So that's the bilateral piece. I think the other part that's important to emphasize about the visit was White House officials were saying that this was also an opportunity to be quote-unquote a springboard for what they're looking to do on Southeast Asia for the rest of the year. Obviously, like you mentioned earlier, ASEAN and Southeast Asia has been a critical part of the U.S. And the Obama administration's investment in its so-called rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. And Obama wants to highlight that, unsurprisingly, during his last year in office before he gets out. And so the Singapore part is kind of the big rollout of the Southeast Asia piece of the end of his administration. But you're also going to see two important things that are happening at the very least. The first is, you know, Obama's going to be going next month to attend the next round of ASEAN Summitry in Vientiane, and he'll become the first U.S. president to visit Laos. So lots planned there in terms of U.S.-Laos cooperation. The second thing is Aung San Suu Kyi is going to be visiting the
Right.
United States, likely in September. And so you're going to see, I mean, Myanmar has been a critical part of the president's legacy. So you're going to see a lot of emphasis there on what the president's going to look to do for his last year in office.
Within the ASEAN
The
10, let me just ask you real quick. Within the ASEAN 10, how does the United States really see Singapore's role? I mean, my understanding is that Singapore is sometimes seen as the grown-up in the room in a lot of these ASEAN meetings. I mean, especially this summer, over the South China Sea and all these other things, we've seen a fair degree of discord and disunity within ASEAN. So, how does Singapore fit into that from the U.S. approach?
Yeah, so I think the United States views Singapore as one of the more mature partnerships that it has in the region. So while it's looking to invest in these relationships like in Laos and Myanmar, Singapore has kind of been the more mature hub in where the United States looks to engage regionally. So what the United States has been looking to do with Singapore is not only invest bilaterally in the relationship, but look at what the U.S.-Singapore relationship can do for the region more generally. And a good example of that is back in 2012, U.S. and Singapore reached an agreement on something called the Third Country Training Program, where the United States and Singapore would work together to both jointly facilitate development cooperation with the countries of the Lower Mekong. So a lot of the lesser developed countries like Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar, so on and so forth. So I think that's where the Obama administration looks at Singapore to do. It's sort of, you know, what are the regional initiatives we have going on, and how can Singapore kind of fit into that as a opportunity for us to engage the region more broadly? I think on the South China Sea, Singapore has a particularly special role to play in the next few years because it's a country coordinator for the ASEAN-China dialogue partnership. These things rotate, but the Singaporeans are going to be responsible for that. So you've seen Singapore already play a really strong role in, despite the fact that ASEAN is being chaired by Laos this year, which is a relatively weak chair, the Singaporeans have been playing an important facilitating role in making sure that some of these agreements and joint statements actually get done, preparations are advanced, and that ASEAN-China relations remain at least on a, I mean, it's not exactly very stable, but at least the tensions are not getting out of control. So I think what President Obama mentioned in his press conference with Prime Minister Lee was, you know, Singapore is often the grown-up in the room, as you mentioned. And I think that's very much how Washington views Singapore and its role in the Asia Pacific.
Right, specifically in Kunming, I remember Singapore played a pretty important role in the lead up to that statement issue. Right?
Exactly,
Yeah.
right. And that you know, the South China Sea came up in discussions with both leaders. But one of the other interesting things that came up in the press conference, and you and I can maybe pivot to a discussion about this, was the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
And that's, you know, essentially what dominated a lot of the news coverage here, which was Prime Minister Lee making a very strong case about how U.S. commitment and credibility is on the line in terms of getting this agreement done. And President Obama saying that he remained committed to getting it passed. And, you know, I was on Capitol Hill yesterday, as I mentioned to you, speaking to a few folks there about what we might see once, you know, the original theory was we might see a passage during lame duck session. But some of the signs that we've been getting, Speaker Paul Ryan saying that, you know, it's not worth it to have a TPP vote because there's no support. Letter from several Republicans who had initially voted for Trade Promotion Authority telling the White House not to even send it for a vote, doesn't really bode very well for TPP. But, you know, I'd be interested to get your take on this because it essentially boils down to a question of, is this a question of just when TPP gets passed or a question of if? And I think that would very much depend, at least if it doesn't get passed in the lame duck session, whether you have a Clinton or a Trump presidency. I think if you have a Clinton presidency, a few of her surrogates and advocates in the past week have been privately trying to reassure folks that, you know, the specific nature of her opposition is that she's opposed to the trade deal in its current form. And so she's open to potentially revising it. Whereas Donald Trump has a very ideological opposition to free trade. And I'm not sure if that is as reversible in a Trump presidency as it would be in a Clinton presidency. But, you know, maybe I'm being too optimistic. So it'd be interesting to get your read on where things are. You've written about this a lot in the past, too.
Yeah, no, I've been tracking the TPP pretty closely. And I must say, you know, I think Lee was a fairly eloquent spokesperson for the other 11 countries that aren't the United States when he said what he did about the TPP. I mean, first of all, I think a lot of people don't realize simply how painstaking and technical the negotiations are for a trade deal of this magnitude. I haven't read the entire TPP. I think few people have. It's about 3,000 pages long, very technical document. Took several years to negotiate. And essentially what you have to realize is that you have 12 countries, each of whom are trying to balance the interests of various special interest groups, various aspects of public opinion, trying to come up with a trade deal that is, you know, showing some of the highest standards that have ever been seen in any trade deal since really NAFTA. And so, you know, what that means is that there's really no scope for this to be renegotiated or for negotiations to open up again. When Lee was saying that he didn't want negotiations to open up again, what he really should have said is that, I mean, there's no way that this can happen. And, you know, it's a take it or leave it deal right now. And, you know, like you've said, what has made TPP very complicated now is just the political discourse in the United States. And this election year has really seen trade turn into a punching bag in a bipartisan sense. One of the ironies of the TPP was that Obama's own party, the Democratic Party, was actually not the primary source, a primary point of support for the legislation, for the agreement. In fact, Obama had quite a bit of support from more moderate Republicans. But obviously, with the rise of Donald Trump, you've seen the party's right flank, the party's more isolationist flank, anti-trade flank, become empowered. And on the Democratic side, I think Clinton's also had her hands tied by, you know, Bernie Sanders' wing of the party, which is also lambasted the agreement. And you're right that Clinton has actually hedged, in my view, her position on the TPP. She said that she'd be open to renegotiating it, which I'm sure she knows is not an option. I mean, she was the former Secretary of State, clearly. You know, she's saying that to leave her political options open. And, you know, I think that you're right about the lame duck session. I wrote about this week for The Diplomat. I really don't see it happening. A lame duck session ratification just doesn't seem like it'll be forthcoming right now. There may be a few things that could change that. One of the things is how the Republicans end up performing down ballot in the elections, and that's kind of a major point of uncertainty right now, what the effect of Donald Trump will be on down ballot races for the Senate. And you know, the other issue is, if Hillary Clinton does win, how big will her victory be? Will it be the sort of landslide that leaves her with enough political capital to spare on a highly unpopular TPP ratification push? If it is, I mean, she could probably eat that, but, you know, TPP isn't the only issue by any means that she'll need the Senate for. I mean, there's the nomination of a next Supreme Court justice to fill the ninth seat on the court. So really, there's a lot going on here. But, you know, overall, I think what Lee's remarks should really remind the United States is that the broader question of credibility and continuity will be very important in the Asia Pacific. The Obama administration's clearly staked out a lot of its legacy, a lot of the United States' legacy in Asia, where China is rising and you have competing trade agreements like RCEP and FTAP. They'll really kind of fill the void if TPP does fail to become the law of the land, so to speak, for these 12 countries initially. And, you know, the administration is looking to set up this TPP regime with high standards and eventually, you know, hold that up as a carrot for the non-signatory states to eventually work their way in. You've written about a few other Southeast Asian states that are looking to join as well. So if TPP does fail, I mean, it will be a huge setback to the U.S. position in Asia.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, there's also been, you know, some misreporting about the potential for other countries to just move forward without the United States with TPP. And I think it's important to emphasize not only the fact that you know, that there needs to be a certain percentage of GDP that is required in order to get the agreement through. I think it's 85%.
Right.
And without the United States, that is not possible. But also, secondly, even if folks are talking about potentially revising what the regulations are for going through with it, I mean, the fact is TPP really grew as a hot topic of discussion when the United States and then later Japan both joined TPP. I mean, TPP originally was an agreement called a P4, and it just didn't have that much of weight and heft for it to grab headlines. So TPP, you know, without the United States, I think some people are failing to appreciate it. It's not just simply, you know, Washington, you know, being removed from something and other folks going through with it. It really questions the entire viability of the deal itself.
Right, right. And, you know, that's actually a good reminder about what actually needs to happen for the TPP to enter into force. I actually wrote about this shortly after the agreement came out. That was actually one of the parts I paid attention to quite closely. And so, you know, one of the things that could happen is all 12 members simply ratify the TPP and it comes into effect 60 days after the 12th member ratifies it. That's probably going to be, you know, the simpler option that we're not actually going to see. The other condition, which you briefly mentioned, is that at least six of the original 12 have to successfully ratify the agreement, and those six countries between them have to account for 85% of total GDP, which means that really, without the United States, TPP can never enter into force. So really, you know, there is no if. Washington really has to kind of get its act together and pass the agreement if it's going to take effect. Prashant, I think we'll leave our discussion here for this week. But you know, we should kind of offer a preview of what's to come. Specifically, you know, we've kind of teased out some of the issues in this election here in the United States. But listeners should know that we'll definitely come back and kind of offer a, you know, a broader read of how this election is being perceived in the Asia Pacific. And also, you know, I should mention very briefly that Thailand has a historic referendum this weekend on a new constitution that's surely going to affect the country's politics for the future. So we'll hopefully come back and discuss that next week as well. Thanks for listening.